This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2019, held at Faith Builders from July 29 through August 2.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me begin with a story. This story is taken from a book which I've said is worth its weight in silver. If you take silver and weigh it, you know, silver is worth a fair amount. You put it in the balance. This is a book you want to read, and it's one of those rare books that you can read for story time in school. The parents can read at home. The ministers can read it. The teachers can read it. Everybody will find it equally interesting and equally valuable in different ways. It's profound. And it's called Horse Stories. There are some copies in the bookstore. I think they have about 10 of them down there. And I'll begin by reading. It's about, the setting is in such a way that this older retired horse trainer is telling stories to the children at church while the adults are sitting in the back listening in. And he tells stories about training ponies. Here's one of them. Now it was my time to test my theories on an actual horse, or pony as it turned out. In the pen grazing quietly was a pony they called Will, who might just as well have been named Won't. His main problem, as they told me, was that he was difficult to catch. Oh, so he has a bad attitude, I said. We'll have to change that. I noticed right away that many of the parents now seemed more interested. Changing behavior was one thing, but attitude was a different change altogether. But since the relationship I have with a horse will ultimately determine its performance, that's where I always start. Well then, how do you catch him? I asked. Usually with an apple, one of the children said. Show me, I responded. An apple was soon produced from somebody's lunch pail, with a halter and lead rope hidden behind his back, and the apple offered an outstretched hand. A boy named Isaiah entered the pen and approached Will, who eyed him suspiciously. Finally, Will stretched his neck out as far as he could and grabbed the apple. But before he could make his escape, Isaiah slipped the lead rope around his neck and got him haltered. So, I asked, was that an example of prompt, cheerful obedience? Everybody agreed that it wasn't. I summed it up by pointing out that we'd actually given Will the apple as a reward for bad behavior. I told Isaiah to set him free again. What else might work? I asked. The children suggested that if 5 or 6 of them worked together, they could surround him and he'd have to give in. I asked them to show me how that might work. After waving of arms, a stampeding pony, yelling, and a few reinforcements, 8 children finally managed to encircle him while he stood to be haltered. Was that prompt, cheerful obedience? I asked. The response was unanimous. No. Personally, I don't believe a trained pony ever needs to be caught, I said. We only catch things that are trying to escape. If we spend a little time training here, I believe this pony will choose to come to me. With that said, I entered the pen with a halter and a lead rope and a whip, and laying the whip on the ground in the middle of the ring, I walked toward Will, who immediately began trotting around in the pen to keep his distance from me. Looks like he wants some exercise, I said. I calmly noted. Now, picking up the whip and giving it a sharp crack, I encouraged Will into a gallop as I walked in small, peaceful circles in the center of the pen. Will's rebellious expression soon left as he worked. I walked until he gave a sideways glance at me as if to say, what do you want? I immediately lowered the whip and took a step back, at which point he took the opportunity to stop. Look at me. I said, good boy. Patted my leg and walked toward him. Before I had traveled half the distance between us, he trotted off. I remarked, I guess he's not through yet. Another crack of the whip set him off again at a gallop while I walked my small circles. We repeated this a few more times, with me getting closer each time, until he was finally glad to stand as I walked up to him. By now he was so sweaty I just scratched his itchy forehead and stepped back, patting my leg. He followed me, so I scratched his forehead again. After repeating this a few more times, those watching thought he was cured. But I knew better. That rebellion was still there inside, resenting this whole training session. It finally overcame him, and he spun away, only to be returned to enforced exercise. We could see pretty quickly he'd realized he'd made a bad trade. This time, when he turned toward me, I lowered my whip, patted my leg. He came right up to me, followed me around the ring. He had proven to himself that the most peaceful place to be was at my side. At that point, a better name for him might have been Willing. Now everyone had a picture of prompt, cheerful obedience and how attitude needs to accompany performance. And we were ready to apply that knowledge throughout the day. Tied to the rail next to the fence near the pen was a beautiful pony, though fat as a pig, named Jewel. From a distance, we could see that nothing was wrong with her, but as we approached, the problem became obvious. Her hooves were in terrible shape. "What seems to be the problem here?" I asked. "We can't pick up her feet." "Well, of course you can't, but can she?" "Well, yes. Then what's the real problem?" "I suppose it's that she won't pick them up for us," one of the children responded. "That's a good answer, and it means this is a training issue. I believe we can change that," and I don't have time to read you more, but he was able to have that horse willingly pick up its foot when he asked him to, by the horse's will. This session is on laying a solid preschool foundation, and you wonder why a session like this at a teacher meeting where we're teachers and we don't have preschools. Well, one reason is that this subject is so critical and so foundational today that it really doesn't fit for hardly anybody to address it, and so it doesn't get addressed. But the fact is that the schools are the ones who receive from the home. They're the first ones to receive in the school, as the children come in from the home, the, for lack of a better term, the product of the home. And in the last decade, there has been a shift parenting and in child training that is phenomenal. I've never seen anything like it in my 68 years. We often talk about pendulum swings, authoritative to permissive. This is not a pendulum swing. This is a taking the pendulum off the clock, or dispensing with the clock, whatever you want to call it. This is not simply a correction. And it's so profound and so pervasive in our society that even secular authors are producing book after book, such as Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Or The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. Or The Collapse, Parenting, Gospel Principles That Can Radically Change Your Family. Now, this is a positive one. These point out some of the problems. This is by a Christian author, and it's on the back of your handout, Parenting by Paul David Tripp. I don't have this one here. I have two by Tripp, but this one is not here. You may, but you can add it if you want. It's simply called Parenting. The Epidemic is on here. The Epidemic is by a pediatrician, and it's on raising secure, loving, happy, and responsible children in an era of absentee and permissive parenting. And here's another recent one, The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. there are numerous people sounding the alarm, and what's happening is that I have no clue where this came from or why, but it's pervasive. It isn't just out there. It's among us. We have children coming to school who say things like, I don't have to answer a question if I don't want to. Why should I answer a question? I suppose I don't feel like doing this. I don't want to. And you can't make me. Or we have, teachers used to exercise gravity in the classroom by the look. You know what the look is? You just kind of look. Now we have young people saying, the teacher's angry at me, calling teachers out for being angry. Does this make any sense? Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay. Well, so we can lament, but let's look at the positive end of this. So on your outline, what the purpose of this outline, by the way, it's intended as a resource. Let me point out the three pages. First of all, the front page is a page of kind of covers the different aspects of a child's life and the kinds of things that parents need to be doing in the home. And so it's discipling guidelines, and then it breaks that down into emotional, social, moral, spiritual, miscellaneous. And then the second page is more specific things that a first grade teacher is hoping that the children have in place when they arrive in school. So these are more language thinking things, listening, understanding. And then the third page, rather than being categories, is simply a list, kind of a grab bag or a smorgasbord of kinds of specific activities that parents can do with children that achieve some of these goals. And so the school is in a position to share this kind of information with parents at parent-teacher meetings. You have parent-teacher meetings, and you're looking for good topics. You can share in parent-teacher meetings. You can also provide lists of helpful information to young families when they have, maybe after they have their first child and the child's settled in, you can give them a list like this. And so there are various ways. This is intended as a resource list. I've compiled these things from various sources over the years. It's not copyrighted. You're free to reproduce, adapt, whatever. And so I'm going to highlight some things on this list and have a few pictures to illustrate it along the way. And so starting out, I'm saying that step number one is that parents need to disciple their children. The word discipline really means disciple. It's not spanking. It's not punishing. Those things have their place. Discipling is the big picture. And it involves training them. There is a distinct difference between teaching and training. When you teach, you use words. You explain some things. You state some things, and the person understands. And when they understand, they understand. They may not do it. They might not necessarily do it, but they understand. And when you train, the person may not know he's being trained. He may not understand, but he does it. If you're trained to do something, you do it. If you have not been trained, if you don't do it, you have not been trained to do it. And this is, there are parents today, many of them have no clue. Now, by the way, we don't have a choice of whether or not we train our children. We're always training them by default, if not by intention. We're training them by the way we deal with them. And our goal is to train them from being willful to being willing. And there's a difference. If you're willful, you want it your way because you want it your way, not because of what this thing is. And so sometimes you might actually want to do this thing that you're asked to do, But because you were asked to do it, for that reason, you don't want to do it. That's being willful. I don't want to do it now, but then after a while, then, you know, I really do want to do it, but after a while, then I will do it. And it's possible to train children to cheerfully be willing. And this is a question, there's no formula for this. It's a basic thing. God gives parents to children, and he will give them the wisdom to train their children, but you've got to do it. See that they obey. And another one is to behavior is learned. Number two, model expected behavior. Children will, the behavior of children was learned somewhere along the line. If they misbehave, well, either they saw other people misbehaving and copied that, or they just weren't disciplined, or whatever. And so children who quietly fold their hands and close their eyes, somebody trained them to do that. If children wait in line patiently, they were trained to do that. That doesn't happen without training. And many times our training happens by default. When I mean by default, I'm saying by simply not paying attention to what is happening. By overlooking something, you're basically saying what you do there is okay. The child who, if you expect a child something as simple as looking it out, here's one example of an opportunity that has huge implications beyond this thing. It isn't all that important, absolutely, that a child shakes hands with an adult, looks them in the eye, and says their name. But if a child is trained to do that, it has a snowballing effect. It has huge effects in other ways. And so this is one simple example that parents can, at church on Sunday morning, now some adults don't notice children, but for those who do, when they look at this child, oh, good morning, and reach their hand, that child doesn't have to hide behind the mom's leg. Now, children will normally do that, and it's understandable. But they can be trained to say hello, and it's possible actually to say your name when you're asked your name. And choosing a couple things like that, we heard about being strategic this morning, choosing a couple things like that and strategically training the child to respond, they actually can, it isn't really all that hard to do. It isn't all that hard to look and smile and say, hello, or my name is, you know, Susie, somebody asked the name. Behavior is, habits are developed. And, of course, consistency is important. Children can be trained to do things willingly. When it comes time to put things away, something as simple as putting away the toys, it's not quite as easy, but almost as easy to put the toys away as it is to get them out. And children have a lot of energy. And so when it's time to clean up, when it's time to put things away, the child can be trained that actually, when you put everything away again, and there's a satisfaction. Now it's cleaned up. And ready to go. Parents have to believe that it's actually possible for children to want to obey. That it's actually possible for children to be pleased to obey directions. This one, I could talk a long time about, but children should learn that no means no. I'm not talking about no. I'm talking about simply no. I'm talking about a simple direction. A little bit like we have lights in our cities. We have lights that are called yes and no lights. Some people call them red lights and green lights. But you're driving down the street and you get to an intersection and it says no. And so you stop. After a while, says yes, and then you go. And there's no big explosion. It's just simply no. Right now, you wait. And sooner or later in life, we have to learn to take directions from somebody. This is not a big deal. It's not about authority. It's not about imposing the will on other people. It's simply, when the sun comes up, it comes up. God doesn't say, it's morning now. Is it okay if the sun comes up, or do you want it to come up 5 minutes from now? What, how do you feel about that? It's the sun comes up, and the sun goes down. And when it's time to eat, you eat. And when it's time to do things, you just do them. It's no big deal. When we feel, now there's nothing wrong with saying why you're asking a child to do something. The problem with this because thing is if you feel compelled to tack a because onto every no, you're training the child that there cannot be a no without a rationally, logically supported reason for it. And there's nothing wrong with sometimes saying no because so-and-so, but any comments on this? Yes.
For the scenario of shaking hands, mm-hmm. would you advise to practice that just with mom and dad at home, or you don't want to make a scene at church?
Actually, here's where you can use your creativity. You actually could practice it at home. It would be fun. I mean, you can make a game out of it. Children would enjoy that. Especially if you have a couple of children. They like to play church. They like to play anything. And so you could play, and let's play, you know. And so this one child stands there, and then somebody comes up with a cane, you know, and Grandpa's going along, and he reaches out and he, hello, what's your name? And so, yeah, that'd be a nice game. That's a good idea. You could play it. And you say, no, my name is Susie. And so, yes. And when you, and then you can also prep them, say, now, remember, we're going to church now, and somebody will probably ask your name. And so you'll be ready for that. And then, after that, you can have a debriefing when you go home. You did well today. And I saw that you tried, and you made some progress there. And, okay.
You were saying this no and no because. Is there a stage where that changes, probably when they're 10, 11, when you start? See what I'm saying? Like,
the problem is that there are many cases when you get in the classroom, for example, and throughout life, the person who's in charge of an event is simply given directions. This is not a moral situation. It's not anything to discuss. It's simply the way we're going to do this. It's time to do this now. I'd like you people to sit. You know, you might say, let's move to the front. There's nothing morally wrong or bad about that. I don't have to give some kind of logical reason, open this up for debate, why you should fill front seats. There's so many situations that there's six ways of doing something, all of which might be okay, but the person who's in charge simply gives the direction. This is the one of those six ways we're doing it. And it's simply following directions. Let's sit down now and let's be quiet and I'll give you a story. But I don't want to. Well, you know, that's beside the point. Now, it's important to understand age-appropriate behavior. And so, expect, yes, children will play in mud. Expect it, anticipate it. They're being, it's fine. You know, the Apostle Paul said, when I was a child, I what? Felt like a child, acted like a child, I did childish things. And children ought to be free to do childish things. And so you expect it, you understand it, you anticipate it, and you take needed precautions. You might have make sure you have old clothes along for or whatever. And so you understand, for example, if they're afraid of the dark, that's to be expected. They're afraid of, and children have many fears. They give one symptom, I don't want to go along with Uncle Pete's house. And you kind of have this feeling, there's probably something underneath this. Maybe it's, you know, the cousins don't let me play with their toys or whatever. And so You have to be careful. I put this in this section on discipline because you have to be careful that you don't just come down with a firm thinking that they're being disrespectful or disobedient, when actually there's some underlying thing here of their immature or their fears or whatever that is behind this. Teach them your expectations. Sometimes children don't know what's being expected. And so if you expect them to sit with their hands folded at the table or put their hands down to pray, whatever. And let them know if they are reaching your expectations. There are many parents use hyperbole all the time. You're just so good, this is great. And it's just a generic fluff. You know, cotton candy all the year. But be specific. And so if there are things that you expect, let them know what they are and commend them for making the bed properly or whatever. And there is a place for the rod. I won't talk much about that, but don't expect the rod to do it all. There's a huge need for instruction and training other than the rod. Let's go down to emotional development. Children do have feelings. Children are great feelers. And they actually operate more from feeling than they do rational reason. And this is a reason why many parents are doing their children a disservice, and there's a whole book about this, how we hurt our kids when we treat them like grown-ups. So sometimes seven-year-olds, and they seem like almost like 17-year-olds, the way their parents talk with them, interact. But when they're 17, they seem more like 7-year-olds because they actually aren't that mature inside, and you attempt to, you don't recognize that these children are not rationally driven at that age. Some of us aren't even at our age. They're much more likely to respond to their feelings. But they need to be trained to keep their feeling. It's okay to jump around when you're happy. But then, depending on where you are, you know, you don't jump up in the middle of church and stand on the bench. And if you're upset, that does give you no excuse to throw toys across the floor and hit somebody with them. You have to keep your feelings under control. Teach them how to handle their feelings. Provide opportunity for children to care. Children have to both learn to receive affection and also to give it. Some children don't get that opportunity. They have to be able to, just caring for something, their little garden plot, their plant, their toys, and being able to receive affection from grandparents and others. Encourage trying. You can do it. Children who have not been encouraged to try when they come to school, teachers have a great test. I can't do this. I can't. Well, now, the whole issue about the whole problem with this is that if these things are not in place, when the child comes to school, the teacher can't do this. The teacher can't do all these things in a couple months or a year. So, okay. Encourage thoughtful behavior. Encourage affectional, thoughtful behavior. And so, yes, children do tend to react, but do encourage them to think. And moving on to social development. I won't read all these off. Responsibility, chair, so forth. But let's go down to number 5 under social development. Teach them to play. And I'll say a bit more about that later. But there's all kinds of play. And I will say this at this point, that this is another crisis in our day. It's a sad thing that many children do not know how to play. Who knows what I'm talking about? how can that be that a child does not know how to play? I have no clue where this comes from. I mean, children, over generations, you see pictures of books. I mean, artists, you see these famous pictures in history books of children in the schoolyard playing crack the whip and skating. Children, for generations, have played. That's what a child does. He goes outside and he plays. And somebody told me this the other day that this was here, that their child, children didn't seem to know what to do outside. So that actually took, this is his own children, took him outside. And let's pretend that that's, you know, this is your house here by the tree, and this is my little barn or whatever, some kind of a, to exercise imagination. Oh, and what the children kind of, it seemed like something sparked inside, and so they, something got turned on inside. They kind of enjoyed this. And guess what? The next day, the children were out there playing by themselves. The dad didn't have to do it. And it seems that, for whatever reason, our children need to be told or shown how to play. And a child needs to be... Children will insist that their parents play with them. Some will. My daughter-in-law, she grew up with a strong will, and she has a daughter. My granddaughter has a very strong will, but she's doing a great job with her. And her, my granddaughter, would want her mother to come and play with her. Well, her mother has things to do. She has bread to bake and clothes to wash and so on. And it's not that she didn't pay any attention to her. So she's happy to look at the things she's built or the things she's colored or whatever. But the child simply had to be told, you know, go play. You have dolls, you have toys, whatever, go play. And so there's such a thing as individual play. You ought to be able to do quiet play, romping play outside, working play. That's the kind of play where you put on your little apron and have your own little mixer, and you kind of play as though you're doing an adult thing while mom is cooking. You have your own little thing to cook, that kind of thing, or your own little garden. Maybe you have two plants in your garden. That kind of thing is critically important for children's development. And interactive play with other people, and then imitative play where you play farm, play school, play fireman. There are children who are they've got play disability. And I don't know where it came from. I've never seen anything like it in the 50s or 60s or 70s. It used to be, there's a number of factors. One of them is the electronic world. But even children who are not immersed in the electronic world, it still affects them for whatever reason. So, and by the way, these children, it's not the children's fault. This can be learned. Children can learn to play. If it's not spontaneous, why then somehow the pump has to be primed. And children are very quick learners. A child only has to see something done one time. They can see somebody throw a temper tantrum one time, and they can practice themselves. Oh, this is really something. I can do it myself. So if they see a little playing done, they can do it. Let's move on to... Yes. Let's go down to moral development. Strangely enough, this is another thing that it seems that children used to pick up. Growing up in a culture in which we have a shared morality, they just pick this up. What's kind, what's right, how you act, how you shouldn't act. But, and we all know, especially as Christians, we know... We've said over the generations that morality is not religion, right? It's not religion. We know that you can be a good moral person and not be a Christian. But it seems it's almost gotten to the point that we know that you have to have faith in Christ and you have to grow up and accept Christ in your heart. But it's almost like we've lost sight of the fact that you actually do have to have morals. And morals can be taught. If they're not being picked up from the culture around you, you're going to have to teach them. And so the simple moral qualities like respect for other people and good manners. This says good manners is grows out of honoring other people as people. And so you take into account when other people are present, and you don't talk when they're talking, you don't, and so forth. And just things like gratitude and kindness. And a good way to do this is simply some sayings. I suppose if we had time here, we could all tell some sayings that our parents would have told us. And one saying can go deep. I remember my one aunt would say, "Well begun is half done." You ever hear that? "Well begun is half done." If you get a good start on something, it's about half done. Because once you get, sometimes getting started is the, or if you first you don't succeed, try again. I remember one statement my father made when I was about 11 or 12, and it was this: "Must I tell you every move to make?" And that went deep. That became part of my operating system. And you have to understand a boy about 11 or 12 living on the farm. And you know, it's like two kinds of people that don't amount to much. Those who cannot do what they are told, and those who can only do what they are told. And so if you can't take direction from somebody, you're going to have a hard time finding a job or keeping a job. But on the other hand, if you can't notice a few things yourself that need to be done, and say, "Well, why did you go down that road? It said road closed." "Well, the map said go that way, or the GPS said turn down there." "So, well, didn't you see the sign?" "Well, we can't come and think." And so there are few things that children can be... All right, that's cool. It should go without saying, read Bible stories, although today there are many children in a society around us that are totally illiterate. They don't have a clue who Jonah was. So, anyway, Bible stories. Another one, let's jump down to miscellaneous. Don't forget to teach safety skills. It's pathetic how many children get hurt today. Riding on daddy's lap in a lawnmower, or of all things, riding on a skid loader bucket. There are still people who actually have their child get on a skid loader bucket and they go driving around. And they're asking. All right. Avoid excessive stimulation. This is a huge... You're setting a child up. You are training your child to be dissatisfied. If you give that child toys, you go... This kind of a thing. Because when I was a child, we got bored sometimes. And when we said we're bored, what we really meant was, we've got to sit here with the old people while they're visiting with grandma. And so for this next half hour, we can't do what we'd like to do. We can't walk about and play. But I tell you what, as soon as we were free to do something, we were not bored. We would talk or do something. Today, when young people say they're bored, what they're saying is that my electronic IV has been turned off. I need a constant IV. I need a constant input, external input, into my life in some way. And if that stops, I'm a zombie. Because there's nobody home. I don't know how to play. I don't have anything to think about. I certainly don't read. And so have the child actually play with real objects. You don't have to get out the stereoscopes. I'm not talking about antiques. I'm talking about things, well, Legos and so forth. All right, let's go now to the next page. Elements of readiness. This is the kind of thing that the first grade teacher is going to say that I want my child to be prepared. So now the first page is general things. This is a page if your parents are wondering when the child's maybe 4 years old or five, going to come to school, and they're wondering, will my child be ready? Well, say, here's a list. And the idea of a list like this is that you look down over the list as kind of a check sheet and see, is this in place? Is this in place? So, first of all, can my child take directions without interrupting? And can he sit and listen? Can he sit down and listen if he's read to? Or can he follow directions and do three or four things, like take out the garbage, feed the dog, close the garage door, and then put your bicycle away? All right, you tell a child to do four things. All right, take the garbage out, wire out there, feed the dog, come back in, make sure the door is shut, put your bike away. It shouldn't be that hard, but no, many children will. They'll come back in. Oh, no, the dog wasn't fed. Or, yes, maybe they fed the dog and spent the next half hour petting the dog, and they came back in and completely forgot to close the garage door or put the bike away. A child who cannot remember a sequence of directions is going to have trouble in school. Teach the child to hear. This is the kind of thing that can be done while you're washing dishes or going down the road or just along the way. You don't have to make a class out of it. But can you hear these sounds? Fable, table. And can you give other names, able, label, rabel, that sound the same, trained to hear? And then children like to play with sounds. And just playing games, sleep, slurp, slide, slam, slither. You can just imagine children having fun playing with sounds. This kind of, and children do that. You hear children babbling and digging. That's very serious business with a child. They're learning to produce sounds, and they're listening to the sounds they produce. And if they can't hear those sounds, they're certainly not going to distinguish them when you try to teach them to read. And another is, yes, simply following directions. Teach them visual discrimination. Toys like this are their ilk. Can you imagine the value to a child? There are about six things going on there at once. You've got to, if you want to put these things in, you pick it up and you look at what shape it is, then you have to find the place it will fit. So you go back and forth, and then you have to manipulate this thing with your hand and stick it in. And so playing with seeing likenesses and difference, manipulation, you'll see this list, these things are so simple and so elementary, but there are children who are not doing this. Some homes don't even have simple things like this. Or, if they have them, they're there, and the children say, there's nothing to do, I don't know how to play. And how? They simply have to interact with them. Understanding concepts, like on top of and around, how could a child grow up without learning what on or off is or beside? Well, some do. Some do. And things like this, you don't necessarily... If a parent had a check sheet like this, if I have a four-year-old, five-year-old, and I wonder, is he going to be ready for school? Well, I could look down this list and say, I could check. And you could just play a little game with your child and give him something. Say, put this on top of that and see if he can do it. Put it beside it. Put it under. Put it against it. Do they know that? And you might be surprised if they don't. Well, then it's not that hard to teach. Or you could play a game, am I against you? Am I beside you? Concepts like that. Descriptive terms. This is the kind of thing that just while you're handling things, you can talk about things being slimy or rough or greasy. Another concepts. Here's the case where if you're reading a book, some books have pictures like this. Children like little games like this. You just say to the child, point to well, you can start by asking them, is this a plant? No. Is this a plant? No. Is this a plant? Yes. Is this a plant? They might say no, because the tree's not a plant, because the tree's... If they say no, well, then you could just say, well, actually, it's a big plant. It is a plant. Don't make a big deal out of it. Is it a plant? Is it a plant? Yeah. And if they say this is a plant and this isn't, you can understand, oh, yeah, they're thinking like a child because they would think a tree's not a plant. But just simple games like that that adults used to kind of do without thinking. It doesn't take a degree in education to think about that this is just, you know, with young babies, you make all kinds of stupid faces with them and make little noises, blah, blah, you know. Goo. Well, that's very important because they're recognizing faces. All right, that kind of comes natural to people to do that. This should come natural too, if you're looking at a book, to just point things out. You know, show me the, you know, is that a goat? Or this is a goat. Is this a goat? And just get them to recognize and think about things. A lot of the things are just fun and a lot of this is done with human interaction with a child on your lap looking at a book. If you give the child one of these plastic things, a battery and a bells and whistles, it goes bleep, 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 while you are oftentimes, the development that happens in this way does not occur. Teach them to speak clearly. Teach them to appreciate hearing speech. 20 froggies went to school down beside a rushing pool. 20 little coats of green, 20 vests, all white and clean. Children enjoy hearing sound like that. Teach them to think. If you're reading a story, stop sometimes. What do you think is going to happen? What's she going to say next? What would you do in this case? Here's a huge one. Adjust to changes. It's time now to put that away and do something else. You don't know whether to laugh or cry. But many parents today will never say such a thing. It will always be, is it okay now if we, yes, it's always calling attention to the child's feelings rather than simply, and I'm not talking about being brusque and rude. I'm just saying, sit here, now it's time to put that away and then we're going to go home. We're going, you know, you're away visiting and say, all right, we're going to, it's time to go home now. Let's come and sit down. We're going to have devotions or whatever. Or something simple. Game is over. He won. Let's play another game. Adjust to changes. And here's another one. A child somebody mentioned this morning. What's that? About a 2-year-old. Might need any help to pour the milk. A child should both be trained to ask for help and also to accept help. It's not about pouring milk. It's about the will. It's about the will. And when a child is told that, I'll help you with this, well, okay. The parent has said he'll help him with that. And so this is not anything to make a big deal out of. If they make a big deal out of it, the big deal is not the milk. The big deal is the will. It's the will. That's what it's about. Okay, coming back to playing. Play with a playful mind and attitude. Cooperatively, a variety of activities. Make sure, and here's where you can look down this checklist. Does my child know how to jump? I heard a gut-wrenching story just the other evening. Somebody, it's a child placed in their home in foster care. This child was kept for I don't know how many years in Pampers. The child was never potty trained. I think he was something like 5 or 6 years old, and was not. I don't know if the child was ever outdoors. Anyway, when they said the child moved, when he moved, his kind of jerky movements. I guess he spent most of his time watching games or whatever videos. And this child, when the child was outside, the child was scared on grass in the lawn. The child didn't know what to do with his feet in grass. Now, we can laugh, but there are children, I mean, I hope that's an extreme. But for whatever, a child, think of how a child feels if he sees other children just bouncing a ball. know, there's an art to balancing a ball. It goes down, that comes up, and it's just, you just touch it with your hand at the right time to get that thing to bounce again. And some of these simple things, just a checklist. Does your child know how to skip? You know, skipping is really something, isn't it? That little half step, you know, take with you. And children can learn it by imitation. And so it's mastering something. A child should master something. When they're old enough, I'm not sure what age a child can master a hula hoop, actually keeping it going around his waist, but at the appropriate time or jumping. But, you know, things like hopscotch, master something. And then child should be able to follow directions, develop perseverance, and experience success. So let's look now at some practical ideas here. So these are categories. So a parent can look down this list, and if you have three children and you go down this list, well, one child might be very, very well. They know how to put puzzles together. You know they do it. With another child, you might say, you know, I'm not sure. Let's check. And so you see whether they can actually do that. Now, this list is simply a list of activities. These are not high-tech or sophisticated. They're things anybody can do, and some of them cover several things at one time. And so here's one, read. Now, this is my wife reading to some grandchildren, and notice there's four different ages there, and every child is having a different experience. I like the expression. This one here has no clue about the book. She's just sitting there and looking at this thing in front of her, right? And they'd be trying to grab something, stuff in her mouth. This one here is, she's following the story. This isn't a heavy-duty story here. The older one here, this isn't his style at all. But this is where the activity is, and Grandma's here, so you know he's sitting there backed up against you because he's having a warm emotional experience here, and he's here because it's, you know, just, right. He has good feels here, good vibes. And then this one here is actually engaged in the story. So each child is having a different experience, and that's okay. When you read aloud to a group at the home in a cross-age group, you read, and sometimes the story is aimed at the older ones, sometimes the younger ones. But reading aloud, if there's one thing parents really ought to be told to do, it, be sure that you read aloud to your children. It's much more than... There are huge things happening. There's togetherness. There's bonding. The children are having experience together. They're having it with whoever is reading. They're learning patience because maybe I have to put up with a story that's below my level or above my level. You go on and on with the things that happen when you read aloud. And then conversation along the way. Many of the things on this list can happen along the way. You don't have to have homeschool. I'm not saying you shouldn't do homeschool with preschoolers, but you don't have to. You can capitalize on the opportunities while you're washing dishes, whether you're singing, telling stories, having fun with words, or driving down the road. We often spend a lot of time traveling. When you're traveling on the road, a good time to develop conversation about things you go past, tell stories, and if you have opportunity to connect with another generation up, there are so many rich opportunities to interact with people along the way. And then practice words, speech patterns, finding nursery rhymes. These nursery rhymes, Hickory Dickory Dock, the mouse, when you want, three mouse ran up the clock, the mouse ran up the clock. That's not about the mouse. That's about sounds and producing sounds and the music of language and the flow of language. That's what's happening in those things. And the fact that they're kind of imaginative or nonsensical, actually that free-willing kind of thing with the Humpty Dumpty, that kind of does capture the child's imagination, but it's as much about language as anything. And then storytelling. And children can make up stories. So you can start a story. Once upon a time, there was a little boy, he went outside, and he went to take the garbage out, and when he got to the garbage pail, he heard a noise inside the garbage pail. All right. And then, now, you pick it up and you tell, you continue the story. And with the why questions, answer according to their level of understanding. And then you can ask some of your own questions. Now, this reflects my mentality. Not everybody would ask these questions, but I would be inclined to ask at the appropriate age, why does the dishcloth get wet when we dry the dishes? Where does the water come from? Well, it should be rather obvious, but you're just thinking about things. Why does it get dry when I hang it up? Where does it go to? The mailman comes every day with the mail. Where do you think he gets it? Or how do crickets make a noise? I mean, you can ask your questions, too. Children ask you questions. You can ask them questions just about everyday life. And it's fun to do that along the way. They don't have to be heavy-duty questions. This kind of thing is a powerfully educational activity. There are books and magazines that have this kind of thing, and children can do this. They can really enjoy it, where you find this. What's happening there is it's visual discrimination, and it's figure ground. It's being able to pick out this little figure in the midst of everything else. And then there are things like memory games. Those little cards. That's hugely valuable for children. Very simple things, but very, very valuable. They don't even have to be able to read for some of these memory games. And it's simple things like taking an egg carton and using colored objects and just dropping them in. By the way, this kind of thing, if you want something in your first and second grade classroom for children to do when they have a little extra time, that's profitable, have some things like this in the classroom for them to sort according to color, according to size, according to shape. And then there's the simple things like stringing beads. When you string beads, you're doing several things at once. You're developing fine motor skills. You're also distinguishing colors. You're also distinguishing shape. And you can reproduce a pattern. And you can give them, or they can make their own pattern first. So this is some cards, and you make one like that. And then, of course, building. Hugely valuable to have children build things with this kind of toy. Drawing, tracing, coloring, following directions. Simon Says. Who's familiar with the Simon Says game? Simon Says Stand Up. And what's happening there is that you must pay attention, very close attention, and you must make a snap decision. And don't say because. Simon says stand up because. Just say Simon says stand up. It's just time to do that. Teach them time concepts. Days of the week. Seasons. Introduce number concepts. It's so simple, too. We still have on our garage floor, we have some numbers painted on there from 1 to 20 from when our younger children were learning to add and subtract. And by the way, you should have these in the classroom floor, too, if you have lower grades. So you can actually walk on the numbers. And when you're on 5 and you subtract 2, well, guess what? You end up back on 3. And then you add 6 and you end up on 11, and so forth. Introduce number concepts just along the way. I'm not recommending cereals here. I'm simply pointing out that if you're eating a meal and there happens to be a box of something sitting there, not every day. The children get sick of it, but occasionally point things out. I spy with my little eye. The letter C. Can you see a letter C on there? Memorize things. Have them memorize scriptures. Here's a huge one. Match tones. Your first grade teachers will bless you up and down if your children come to school being able to match their tone. All right, Myron? Match your tone. Sing along with recordings. Encourage singing. And then gross motor skills, playing with frisbees, jumping rope, and riding toys. And then also the fine motor skills, stringing beads, using a scissors, manipulating objects. Nothing high tech. This is not rocket science. On the back is a few resources from some publishers that have some... I still want to get up there to age five, where there's some actual things you can get that are helpful for these kinds of skills. What comments do you have? Comments or questions?
Do you have a suggestion or a thought on what causes the children of today, as you said, to not understand how to play? Like, what can you do so that they go on instinctively knowing that, as children should?
Yeah, I don't know why they don't, but you have to recognize some of them don't. In this school, once upon a time, at recess, like I went to public school growing up, and we were never told what to play when we went in the playground. We went out the door and played. And so I suggest in your school, you should do both. Children should know how to join a game that was picked. In other words, if we're all going to play whatever the game is, tag, or when you're younger, or business based, or whatever, they should be able to cooperate and play a game. But there ought to be other times that you deliberately do not choose a game and say, at our school, we have the teacher at noontime will pick, will make a call. On some days, we just say it's a free day. And, you know, sometimes children will waste 5-10 minutes figuring out what they're going to do. But hey, it's a skill they'll learn. If you always play a group game, when do they ever use the swings, if you have swings or these other things? So you might have to, like that father told me, he realized his children didn't know what to do out in the lawn behind the house, so he actually introduced them to playing imaginative games. Any other comments? By the way, I just noticed that it's so rare today that I notice it if I see it at the four-way stop out here. If you got this back driveway and go up to the four-way stop, they're along the road. Somebody that lives in that house knows how to play. Along the road, they have some improvised stones, and they integrated little pieces of barbells, the dad's barbells, and they have a couple circles, and they have a little pile in the middle. And then integrated in this is a little plastic garage and some matchbox toys scattered around. That child, that's what children used to always do. And any other comments? Did I get to your question at all? You're wondering what we should do about it or what the cause is?
Yeah, both.
I don't know what the cause is.
I wonder, what's the size of the toy boxes now versus the toy box of yesteryear?
That is a problem. A lot of children have too much stuff, and a wise parent will sometimes put 3/4 of it away and just have 1/4 out. Because you can have a child, I mean, literally, if let's just say we cover this room floor with toys, you know, this thick, I wouldn't know what to do in here because... So there is a sense in which they don't need to use their imagination. The more sophisticated the toy, the less imagination they use.
Last summer, Keith built our sons a sandbox, and we try to take our sandbox toys in every night. We don't always get it managed. So every morning when they go out there, it's a new start, and one time we had been at the boy's great-grandparents, and she gave us some little plastic whatevers, and for some reason, our son Asher called them Dovers. I don't know where that came from. And that morning, we hadn't brought the sandbox toys down at all. He didn't have his vent. He didn't have his hi-ho. And they had a great time doving. They imagined it.
Yes.
And this meant over pit. And I don't think they would have gotten that if the sandbox would have been covered with all these plastic toys.
Yeah, playing in the sandbox is such a basic thing that children used to do. And a few things, you know, a couple things, a couple sticks and maybe a tractor or two or a bucket and a shovel.
Well, they spend lots of time playing with their actual effect and stuff, too.
But. Other comments on anything here? Yes.
This is a totally different question.
Yes.
It's kind of a complicated situation. I have parents' schools which figure out easily in the school year. It was not a Benedict family. I wasn't sure if he was ready for school from kindergarten. And we decided to try it, but I was really... Sure. But in January now, he started not being able to keep up as a rest of the schoolers.
Mm-hmm.
So with the principal and I were talking, and he said, tell the parents there's a possibility of him repeating first grade, which I know in some schools, since I've been here, they would have said they would have done some other things, but that's really relevant. The parents were not okay with it. Mm-hmm. What was the reason that he would not have felt good from his peers? Now, I don't, our school culture, I know it well enough that it would not have been an issue.
Okay.
But it felt like she was from a public school setting.
Yeah.
And the whole feel-good thing.
Okay.
How do you, like, I don't think it's creeping too much into our schools, but it's starting to.
Let me say a little more about this this feel. What's happening is that parents are, for whatever reason, I don't know, this just creeps in from, I don't know. It's like mushrooms all across the country. It grows up in all homes. It's like mushrooms. They pop up. And here's a symptom. A parent will say, I'm going to exaggerate a little bit. Do you want your Cheerios, the cereal on your plate first and then the milk, or the milk first and then the cereal? Do you want the spoon on the right side or the left side? Do you want Daddy to wave goodbye with his right hand or his left hand? Okay, I hope I'm exaggerating, but do you know what I mean? They're introducing either or in almost every move we make throughout the day, if you ask them, either they don't know they're doing it, or they would say that. If they're trying to be philosophical about it, they probably say they're teaching the child to make choices. But that's not the area to have them make choices. What you're doing is creating in these routine direction type things, you're calling the child to stop and think about my preference, how I feel about this. Leonard Sachs has a book called Boys Adrift. He's a pediatrician, and pediatricians are they don't know what to think. This man has been in practice for 30 years, and he just says in the last 10 years, parent brings a child in, child has a cold, so he does the pulse, and now it's time to do the ah, you know, in the throat. So now I'm going to, he tells the child what he's going to do. You open your mouth and ah. And the mother intervenes. She says, oh, he wants, is it okay if the doctor, he's going to have a light, and he's going to do that, and he's going to look down your throat. And the child, oh, no, this sounds, this sounds gross. So this was a five-minute ordeal that ended up with a bargain that on the way in they stopped for ice cream. And so finally the child agreed to have the mouth open, and the puzzle. And this pediatrician, what's going on here? This, this was not the way it was 10 years ago, and in the epidemic, he writes about the voice being at a restaurant. Somebody comes in and sits at the next table with a 2-year-old, and he says, as soon as I hear the voice, that sweet saccharine type voice of the mother, I know there's going to be an ordeal. And the mother says, "Is it okay? Okay, there's a crayon and some coloring on the, you know, on the table." Question. Mother said, "Is it okay if I use one of the crayons?" Asked her child. He said, "If it be no adult would say that to another adult. I mean, it's here. You just pick them up. There was a couple crayons. You just pick one up." And he said, "Sure enough, within 5 or 10 minutes, there was a big blow up of some kind. I think they actually walked out of the restaurant without their food. It's worse than pathetic. So what happens is that they're asking them, it's a focus on my how I feel about this. And I talked about training. Training is more powerful than teaching. So we're actually training our children to consider whether they want to do every little thing they do. Everything. But then, when it comes to areas where they really ought to make a choice, such as, now it's time to play. And, you know, you could play with the Legos, or you could play with your doll, you could go outside the sandbox. You know, you've got to choose one and go play. Now they're handicapped. Now they can't choose. Now they don't know what to do. And so the very the very constant badgering them with these choices over things that don't matter is somehow having the exact opposite effect of teaching them to make choices. I don't know what the cause is, but I do know that there's something to do about it. With play, please, teach your children to play. And in this other case, simply give simple directions. It's not being bought. One writer says, this is a secular writer, he says that this whole thing of authority, that parents aren't even sure that they ought to exercise authority over their children in things so simple as, now it's time to take a bath, and so we'll go take the bath. That, there, you know, is it okay? Do you want to, we probably ought to do a bath tonight. Do you want to play a little longer first, or do you want to have the bath first and then the story, or the story first and then the bath? There wouldn't be anything wrong with asking that occasionally, but this is all the time. Where they're getting themselves in a position where they can never say, let's go take a bath. And so I think that if you're simply aware of this, there's a couple simple things you can do. And it is make sure your children play, know how to play. And also make sure that they can simply follow simple directions without making a big deal out of it. Other comments? Yes?
What do you do if you have a...
By the way, you're free to go if you want to. The next session starts...
A child who is perfectly old enough mm-hmm. to be at school, but is not anywhere close to ready on this list of things to do. Mm-hmm. And the parent says, but he will be, you know, 20 years old before he ever gets out of high school. Mm-hmm. So I don't want my child waiting until next year to start.
Yeah. Yes, we're having this. Session's over. You're free to go if you want to.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.